For the week of August 5th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 157, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Sydney, Australia, I'm Michael Giltz.
What are you doing in Sydney, Australia? You're really not in Sydney, Australia, are you?
Well, it's sad news. Just got an email, noticed that art critic Robert Hughes died today. And of course, he lived in the United States for many years. This is where he made his bones. But he was Australian to the core. He's easily the most important art critic of the last few decades here in America. The work of his that I love the most, obviously he's known for The Shock of the New, which talked about the modern art movement. But the work I love of his the most is The Fatal Shore, which is about the founding of Australia. That came out, I think, in 1987. It's just a great narrative nonfiction book. I actually just had a list that I put on my personal blog of 50 favorites, you know, 50 books if you haven't read, you should read theirs. It's not the 50 best books of all time or the 50 most important. It's nothing like that. And they're not all obscurities. There's some oddball stuff you wouldn't have heard of, some you have heard of but haven't read. And on that list is The Fatal Shore by Robert Hughes. So if you love history, if you're interested in Australia or you just want to catch up on a terrific writer, you should check it out.
So you're in Sydney, Australia in spirit, no pun intended.
Exactly.
Well, the funny thing is that when we were putting today's show together, I debated whether I should put this story in about Roy Lichtenstein, the pop artist, and, you know, I guess they found a painting of his that was missing for 40 years.
Oh.
And somebody was trying to sell it, and nobody knew where it was for 40 years, and meanwhile, it was on display in Columbia at a museum, and I guess they found it in a storage locker in New York City.
Well, it's the art podcast edition of Showbiz Sandbox. What else will we cover?
Well, on today's show, we'll give you a mid-summer recap of the season's blockbuster entries and which did well enough to warrant sequels. Let's face it, we know you're already standing in line for Battleship 2, Michael. Speaking of things that are doing well, television ratings for the Summer Olympics are off the charts, though it's not just traditional broadcasts that are providing to be real winners. Do you get what I did there? Do you see what I did there? Real winners?
Winners, like, okay, gold medals.
Like in
medals.
The Olympics.
Okay.
You see
okay,
how I,
okay.
Yeah, no? Well,
bronze.
Hey, I medaled, and according to all of the athletes that I've watched over the past week, you should be happy to just medal.
My mother says silver is the worst.
Why?
You win gold, you win gold. If you get bronze, you say, thank God I medaled. And if you get silver, you're like, damn it.
That's actually very true.
Yeah, tell it to the person in fourth place. Moving on.
Well, speaking of summer games, Snoop Dogg displays some of his basketball skills this week by demonstrating how well he can pivot. We'll explain. We even have some listener email, which comes to us all the way from the great island of Ireland.
Uh-oh.
Of course, Dan, anybody who listened to last week's show will know exactly why this email was sent.
I haven't read it, but I assume it has something to do with my dismissal of 90 years of blood and bitterness that have rocked that continent for so many years.
Along those lines. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office around the world is, of course, The Dark Knight Rises. It grossed another $103 million. It's at $733 million worldwide. It's the second biggest film of the year so far, right behind the Marvel's The Avengers and just passing Ice Age Continental Drift. So it's the second biggest film of the year, and yet it still seems to be slightly behind expectations. It's a little bit behind in North America, a little bit ahead overseas. We'll have to see how it all pans out. It'll probably hit the $1 billion mark, and still people will feel like it could have done more. And number two around the world is that film, Ice Age Continental Drift, the third biggest film of the year. It's grossed $41 million, and it's at $719 million and counting. And number three is the Seth MacFarlane comedy, Ted. That grossed another $37 million. It's starting to open wider overseas. It's at $280 million and counting. And number four, Total Recall, the would-be reboot of the Arnold Schwarzenegger, Paul Verhoeven film. It grossed $32 million worldwide in a fairly soft debut. Plus, the reviews weren't good. Plus, the audience polls weren't good. Look for this one to drop heavy next week. At number five around the world is Brave, the Pixar film that grossed $19 million worldwide. It's at $341 million and counting. And number six, another debut in North America. This is the third film in the Wimpy Kid series, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days, that grossed $17 million worldwide.
And get it, they released it during the Dog Days of Summer. Pretty smart.
Not necessarily. Some people say they should have released it back in March when the first two came out, March or April, when kids were out of school and had some free time. I don't know why they say they don't have free time in the summer, but apparently they thought March and April were better times to release it. Don't ask me why. At number seven is Madagascar 3, the animated film, another $16 million. That's at $523 million and counting. At number eight, an international film. This is the South Korean gangster flick called The Thieves. That grossed $15 million, and it's at $39 million and counting. At number nine, the dance film Step Up Revolution, number four in the series. It grossed $13 million, and it's at $40 million and counting. And at number 10, The Amazing Spider-Man, another $10 million. It's slowing down now. It's at $678 million worldwide. So it's going to have to struggle to get to that $800 million that the other three films in the series registered. And number 11, you won't be surprised that the Ben Stiller film The Watch fell hard. It grossed $6 million. It's at $25 million and fading fast. Some of the other roundups around the world, Prometheus worldwide, that's at $310 million. Magic Mike, the stripper film, is starting to expand overseas. That's at $128 million. And the Moonrise Kingdom passed $40 million in North America, and it's starting to open overseas. The Wes Anderson film was at $43 million worldwide and counting. Quite a good total for a very small, quirky little film.
And, you know, we've received a bunch of email over the past week or two asking us, you know,
saying I'm a bloody idiot.
No, that had to do with Ireland, but about IMAX and specifically The Dark Knight Rises in IMAX, because we were so, you know, really touting going to see that particular film in IMAX because it was shot over an hour of the footage was shot in IMAX. And a couple of the emails ask, you know, well, wait a second. How do you know what footage was shot in IMAX as opposed to the footage that was shot on 35 millimeter?
Stop me if I'm wrong, but when you're watching a movie, it will expand. Like, you'll be watching, if you're watching on a genuine IMAX screen, which is, there's only about 100 in America, right? Or worldwide, I forget.
Yes, the 7 foot tall genuine IMAX, correct.
Seven story tall.
Oh, I said 7 foot. Yes, you're right.
Yeah. You can check out the links from last week's show or the week before to get a list of all the genuine IMAX screens in North America and around the world. And if you're in those theaters watching that movie, it will be showing a more traditional sort of format, and then it will literally expand, and you'll know when you're into the IMAX mode.
Right, and I saw it in IMAX, and I have to say, this was the only film I've ever seen where it was an actual motion picture, kind of a narrative film, where it actually worked. Certainly, Men in Black, listen to me, Mission Impossible 4, Ghost Protocol, there were some moments there that were really, really good, like when Tom Cruise is running around the outside of that building in Dubai. But this really, really worked in IMAX. The problem that I see in shooting with IMAX is that you're right, Michael. You go from, say, a 1.85 aspect ratio to like a 1.33 aspect ratio. And I know I'm fudging a bit there. Those aspect ratios aren't exact. But what happens when you do that is you get all this headroom at the top of the screen because you have more of an image at the top of the screen. And so some of the IMAX footage in parts looks a little awkward because there, you know, it looks almost as if there's too much headroom.
Well, the problem is that there are so few screens you can watch it on, and they want you to pay through the nose to do it. If it looks cool, great. But there, you know, most people who saw it in IMAX, putting that in quotes, saw it in a theater that wasn't a genuine IMAX screen, but just a regular screen branded IMAX, and they paid premium dollars to see nothing like what you saw in that theater. And that's a complete ripoff. And that's the real problem.
Yeah. And there's that scene there in the middle of the film where he kind of, Christian Bale as Batman kind of shows up in the little bat copter thing that he flies around in, and it makes all this noise. And in the traditional genuine IMAX screens, I've saw that scene two or three times in such screens, and the whole building, the whole room shakes, and it really does feel like you're right there.
Well, I didn't see it on a fake IMAX screen. I saw it on a regular screen and didn't care much for the movie. But I didn't fork over big bucks, but a lot of people did. Movie ticket prices this summer are at an all-time high.
That's right. I guess there was a report announced over the last week, and it appeared in The Hollywood Reporter that the average price of a movie ticket has hit an all-time high of $8.12 in the United States.
Thank you, IMAX. Thank you, 3D. And yet, the increase in ticket prices is slowing from prior years. So tickets have been, you know, growing by leaps and bounds, but it's not as bad as it was last year and the year before. Tickets just went up 1.1% compared to a year ago. For the entire half of the year, it was just an average of $8.02. It's that second quarter where the summer season happened that we hit $8.12, presumably because of more 3D films and more IMAX films, meaning films shown on IMAX branded screens where they pay you top dollar just to see a movie with a good picture and sound.
Now, what's interesting to me is, and you know where I'm headed with this particular statement because I've been beating this drum for a while, is that, first of all, let's talk about what an average ticket price is. It's the average all across the U.S.
So somebody pays $19 to see an IMAX film at Lincoln Square on the real IMAX screen in Manhattan. I paid $13.75 at the Ziegfeld. Somebody else in Oklahoma might pay $7 at a matinee. Somebody else will pay $10 for an IMAX screen in, you know, some other city, and so on.
And then a second run theater will charge $4 for it. So
there aren't a lot of second run theaters left anymore, are there?
There are actually more than
a couple
you'd think.
Hundred. You know,
more than you'd think. I mean,
some drive-ins, whatever. Yeah,
but
with
okay,
DVDs,
so,
I feel like they're not really a factor anymore.
Right, and that's not a weighted average. In other words, it's not saying you know that most.
You add up all the prices and you figure out the average.
Right. So there's that. But then my big beef is that certain industry trade groups have been saying that ticket prices have risen at a rate that is lower than inflation since 1968. But you have to go all the way back to 1968 to say that, because in 1995, the average ticket price was $4.35 in the United States. It is now $8.02. So we've gone up, what, 80, 90%?
Right.
So has inflation been that high? I don't think so.
No.
So if you say, look, over the last 10 years or over the last 15 years, you know, ticket prices have kept pace with inflation. That's not true. They've outpaced inflation.
Well, they want to pretend they want to put the best possible face on what they're doing. But the fact is that they're charging a lot more. How much was it?
$4.35. Yeah.
$4.35 in 1995.
Correct.
So that would be, using a conversion chart, that would be into today's dollars, $6.56. So if it kept pace with inflation, the average ticket price would be $6.56. In fact, it's an extra 25% more. It's at $8.12. So, you know, it's a significant jump of $1.50. $1.56 to be exact.
In other news during this week in math.
Well, yes. Yeah. So in other words, no matter how they slice it, ticket prices are rising high. One reason they're not growing at such a torrid pace in the last two or three years is because people are turning against 3D films. They don't like the experience. It's a ripoff for most movies, and they haven't figured that out about IMAX, but they are figuring that out for 3D. Most movies aren't really designed to wow you that much in 3D. It's not worth it even if they're shot and designed to be shown in 3D. When they're converted afterwards, even if it's done with care, it's really not that big a deal. Little kids hate it. On and on and on. People are turning against 3D. And that's the one big reason I think that those prices are not increasing as quickly as they have been.
Well, that might be true, but I'm sure that some of the successful films from this past summer, when we see sequels to that to them, like so...
As we will.
You know, Ted, I'm sure we'll have a sequel, and maybe even a Men in Black 4, because that film did Men in Black 3 did incredibly well. I'm sure the ticket prices will be even higher.
Well, they'll always keep going. They're never going to go down.
One can hope.
So which films do you think will deserve that higher ticket price come next summer and the summer after when we're seeing sequels to the movies we saw this year?
Well, we often talk about which films make sense for a sequel here at Showbiz. Apparently, we're a lot more cautious than I think most studio heads are and studio executives. No one expects a sequel for Battleship or John Carter, even though I kind of joked about that earlier. You know, these are the two duds that both happened to star Taylor Kitsch of Friday Night Lights. He's had kind of a bum year on that regard. You know, even his Actioner Savages from Oliver Stone probably won't get the prequel treatment or the sequel treatment or the midquel sequel. You know, we don't know what kind of quel that film will get, but it probably won't be anything. Dark Shadows is also pretty much out of the question. That's the Tim Burton film. But here are some other summer movies and The Hollywood Reporter's update on which will return to the big screen. Now, I'm going to see how Michael does in this.
Okay.
So Snow White and the Huntsman, it cost $170 million. It grossed $388 million. Sequel or no sequel?
No sequel. You're lucky to get away with not losing your shirt.
Ooh, okay. So you don't think that it has nothing to do with a philandering director that was philandering with, oh, by the way, his star who was half his age and breaking...
Well, the studio wouldn't care about that. What? If they get upset about directors sleeping with their stars, the Hollywood will screech to a halt.
Well, Michael, the studio says, yes, that the philandering director, as we have called him, we haven't even said his name, Russell Sanders, may not be involved, but his star, should we mention her, Kristen Stewart?
Sure.
She's signed up for a sequel, and they're working on a script, and the studio wants it to be a franchise series.
Snow White takes on Cinderella? I don't know. Snow White v. Cinderella, like Aliens versus Predator. Maybe that's their idea. Whatever.
That would actually be funny.
That would be kind of.
I think the Wayans brothers should do that one.
Oh, God.
So let's go to another...
You could be a studio head.
Exactly. Let's go to another Universal film. Ted. Now, this was the $50 million film that so far has grossed $280 million worldwide, and it's still out, so the grosses keep coming in. Sequel or no sequel, Michael?
Well, it's probably a bad idea. It's sort of a one-off nutty thing, but they're going to make a sequel. It made too much money, as long as Seth MacFarlane wants to make one.
Funny you should say that, because the studio says, yes, they are thinking about a sequel, and that Seth MacFarlane wants to make one and can think of a sequel to the unlikely comedy hit. He'll do it. Mind you, Universal still hasn't been able to make a sequel to the no-brainer Bridesmaids. They haven't made that happen yet, so maybe they don't want to repeat the same dumb mistake twice, and they'll figure out a way to do this.
Right, they had that big R-rated hit, and for some reason they couldn't pull the trigger. Then they sort of insulted the stars. They lowballed them on the gifts after the movie became such a big hit. You know, they didn't pamper them and make them feel, appreciated for what they'd given them. And they just sort of blew it on that one.
Yeah, they didn't give them big bonus checks. This is somewhat customary when a film becomes a sleeper hit.
Yeah.
Well, now let's move on to 20th Century Fox with Prometheus. This is the Ridley Scott prequel, midquel, whatever kind of quel it is for Alien. Cost at least $130 million. And to date has grossed $310 million worldwide. Sequel or no sequel, Michael?
No way. You're very happy. I got terrible reviews. So you're very happy again, like Snow White and the Huntsman. Not a good movie. Not a lot of good reviews. No enthusiasm for it particularly. Fans came out and they didn't like it. So you're like, whatever, you know. You're just lucky that you didn't lose your shirt again. You should just walk away.
Well, the studio says, midquel? Absolutely. Fox says they're actively pursuing this and they're pushing it forward, and that everyone wants it to happen by, say, like 2014 or 2015 for the next installment.
Everyone meaning the studio and Ridley Scott, I guess, not fans.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. Now, I wonder if fans want to see another version of the Amazing Spider-Man, which was rebooted this year after three films with Sam Raimi. This episode, this issue, this version, I guess, would be the proper way to phrase that. It costs $200 million, which...
That sounds like a lot.
It does sound like a lot.
Because, I don't know if that doesn't seem... You know, numbers for budgets are really hard to get. Somebody reports a budget number, they can pull it out of their hair. I found somebody who quoted a budget, and I tracked where they got it from and where they got it from. It turned out to be a quote from a person trying to promote studio space in Canada. And this person running this space was claiming what a Hollywood movie's budget was, though they obviously are not a good source for it. But once they gave a number, everybody used that number. So that became the official, unofficial number. So, you know, we do the best we can, but budgetary numbers are very tricky. Studios like to either upplay them and make them sound really big, like we spent a lot of money, or they want to downplay them and say, oh, no, we're being very modest. So it's really hard to get good budget numbers. We do the best we can, but it's really a roll of the dice sometimes. Unless you've got the producer on the record, and even then you got to take it with a grain of salt. It's kind of hard to tell what they cost.
Well, it costs $200 million as far as we know. And yeah, it has earned, so far it's earned about $678 million on the way to roughly $800 million, just like the first three, the Sam Raimi version. Sequel or no sequel, Michael?
I think you would do a sequel. You know, you rebooted it. You've got the new director, Mark Webb. You've got your new star, Andrew Garfield. They've gotten the origin story out of the way. God knows why they felt they had to do it again. But, you know, now the fun can happen, maybe. And they've got this slightly grittier 70s vibe. It did get good reviews, I think, generally. You know, they can build on the success of this one, sort of like Batman Begins, and I would think I would do a sequel.
Yeah, I think this one, to me, is a bit of a no-brainer. The studio says that they're working on a sequel for 2014, but they have one big problem. They have to get someone to write it, of course, and they want Mark Webb to direct it, and he directed The Amazing Spider-Man, but he may not be able to make it in that time frame because he's got a commitment to Fox.
But that's just ridiculous. It's like you tossed aside Tobey Maguire, you tossed aside Sam Raimi, who were delivering you $800 million, movies one after another. You commit to this new young director and star. Why would you throw the director overboard? It's his vision, his movie. Why randomly pick a date and say he better show up in time? Oh, well, we'll have to use someone else. That's just no way to make a good movie and develop a good franchise.
You know, here's why you might not make a good studio head, Michael. You are letting logic and creativity get in the way of a randomly predetermined release date.
I'm sorry about that. I mean, they don't even have a script yet. And they're like, well, it's coming out in 2014.
Exactly.
That's the way they think. First, get a good script.
Well, what about Ice Age Continental Drift? It costs $95 million to produce. It's earned $700 million worldwide so far. It's still out in release. And so will there be a sequel or no sequel?
Let me see if I can do the math. It costs $95 million and it made $719 million. Carry the 2 × 4 square root. Yeah, you're going to make a sequel.
Well, the studio says, duh. Of course they're making a sequel. But Men in Black 3, you know, this is a little bit more questionable. The cost was $220 million.
Yikes.
Plus, of course, you know, Will Smith and Steven Spielberg, who produced the film, they get a huge back end. And it grossed so far $620 million worldwide, which is the most yet for any of the entries, the first two entries in the series. What do you think, Michael? Sequel or no sequel?
Again, this is a series that's just creatively dead. Nobody cares. I mean, it was not necessary, really. It made more than the first two, but it cost more than the first two. Not that they were cheap to make. And to me, it's just such a moribund franchise. I feel like with Will Smith, you know, it's just going to cost you so much to make a Men in Black 4. And it wasn't a massive hit. They probably spent another $100 million to make it. So again, they're practically breaking even, if that, with Will Smith and Spielberg dipping in before they get their money. To me, I would make, if I did it, I would, you know, it's tiresome, but I'd do a reboot. You know, bring the Men in Black franchise into the next generation with some new acts. Not that Will Smith is old or anything, but, you know, the only way to keep it cheap again is to put someone new in there. And maybe if I felt the need to do that, I would do it. I mean, Tommy Lee Jones is cheap, but, you know, Will Smith and Spielberg and, you know, that's a lot of money. I don't think the return was enough really to make it a good idea.
Well, the studio tells The Hollywood Reporter, heck yeah, we're making another one of those if we can.
Now, why would that be? I guess they thought, well, we didn't lose for sure, but we know it's a big movie. We know it'll look good on our schedule. And even if we ultimately don't make a lot of money on it, at least we made a movie with Will Smith and Steven Spielberg.
I guess, yeah.
If they couldn't get it to $800 million or a billion after the first and second iteration, you know, it's certainly not creatively exciting. What the hell, you know, I don't know.
Well, now here's one. By the way, I love this new segment. We should have this as a new segment. I love this game, sequel or no sequel.
So exactly.
We have Big Deal or Big Whoop. We can have sequel or no sequel. But here's one.
Hollywood plays it every day.
Yes, that's very true. This next one, I would never have thought that this could have a sequel. Magic Mike. It cost $6.5 million. It's grossed so far $128 million with bachelorette parties around the world eagerly awaiting its release overseas in more countries than you can count. Sequel or no sequel, Michael?
Sperlin, have you ever been to a bachelor party? You know, a wedding party for bachelors, you know, before the wedding.
Yes, I have.
Have you been to more than one?
Yeah, one or two.
Yeah, and there probably were strippers at both of them. or a strip club or something like that was involved more than once. People don't mind going back to a strip club, even though they already know what they've seen. It's a dumb thing to make a sequel because it's actually sort of a serious film. It's not like Step Up, but maybe they want to turn it into some sort of Step Up stripper franchise where there's the new young stripper, male stripper comes in and we get his backstory. It's kind of stupid because they were trying to make a good film like Boogie Nights, and it's not that good by any stretch of the imagination. It's okay. It's sort of interesting, but I don't think you'd want to follow Channing Tatum again. I think you'd want to, you know, have it be some other young guy coming to the stripper world and, you know, just use that Magic Mike franchise as a way to have young, good-looking Hollywood actors take off their clothes. As long as you can keep the budget under $10 million, it seems like a no-brainer. It's not a creative decision, that's for sure.
How many times have you said stripper in the last 2 minutes?
And Tatum and Soderbergh would just be whoring themselves out to do a sequel to this because there's no need for a sequel whatsoever.
Pun intended or no pun intended on the whoring it out reference?
That's not a pun. That's just a straightforward description.
Okay. Well, the studio says that Tatum and Soderbergh have screenwriters mulling over a prequel and sequel ideas.
Ah, prequel. That's how they keep Tatum in the picture.
That's right.
All right.
Well, what about Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted? It cost $145 million to make. $523 million worldwide has been taken in so far. The original grossed $530 million and the second $600 million. So will there be a sequel or no sequel?
For some reason, unlike Ice Age, this one is getting pretty expensive. I'm not sure what the other two cost, but I assume it was probably pretty pricey. There's a lot of big actors and names involved. I don't know what Ray Romano get. And that's Ice Age. Madagascar 3, you've got Chris Rock. You've got David Schwimmer. Who else is in this
Queen
one?
Not Queen Latifah.
Latifah? She's in Ice Age.
Okay. Who plays the hippo?
I forget. I don't have children. I haven't seen these movies. I haven't seen them more than briefly out of the corner of my eye. For some reason, it's getting expensive. I don't know. You've made three. No, who cares about these movies? If they made a lot more money and cost a little bit less, I'd be more excited. $145, I guess they'll probably do it, even though I wouldn't.
By the way, it is Queen Latifah who voices Ellie. I thought so.
Well, you're right. I'm wrong.
Wait a second. I'm looking up Ice Age when I should be looking up.
That's exactly right.
Madagascar. So, of course, I'm completely confused. You know, I guess that really kind of goes to show you just how confusing it is to parents.
Well, and these are interchangeable, animal movies. Neither of them is very good creatively. Nobody really cares about them, but they make money. So you keep putting them out.
Well, it's Ben Stiller and Jada Pinkett Smith.
Yes. All right.
Well, at least one Ben Stiller movie is making money.
Nice. But not a lot. Not a lot. $523 is not a ton. It costs a lot to open. I guess it's borderline. It's still making what the first two made. They just got to keep the cost down.
Well, I guess this next one is a no-brainer. I mean,
what did the studio say? Are they going to make one?
Oh, you mean on Madagascar 3? Well, if anyone asked, they would probably say yes. But no one has cared enough to ask yet. So the Penguins get their own film, by the way, in 2015.
Oh, okay. Well, those are the breakout guys. They have a TV show, The Penguins. So, that's long overdue.
Well, as I tried to move on before kind of saying what the studio would do to Madagascar 3, this next one's, as I said, a no-brainer. The cost was $225 million, and that's for Marvel's The Avengers. Now, I guess, hold on, watch this. Marvel's The Avengers. Wow, that's pretty good. I should write that down and just run around saying Marvel's The Avengers and watching people laugh. So I don't know whether it cost $225 million. I'm sure it cost a little bit more than that. It grossed $1.4 billion, though. So will there be a sequel or no sequel? Let's face it. There's going to be a sequel. What do you say, Michael?
If you use the word billion when describing the gross, there will almost always be multiple sequels. Only that ship sinking in Titanic. That's the only one without a sequel, and they're probably still trying to figure that out.
Don't tell me how that movie ends, by the way.
Sorry about that.
I don't want
Yes, I mean, how could there not be a sequel?
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I don't know what the studio says on this one, but
they say yes, but not right away. As I recall, they've got Iron Man 3 next summer, then Thor sequels in, I think, November. The Captain America sequel, The Winter Soldier, comes out in next spring. And then Guardians of the Galaxy, which is their big new introduction of a string of heroes, that comes out next summer, late summer, I think, August of 2014. So that means all those movies, they say, are going to happen before Avengers 2 comes out. And they are hoping that 2 + 2 = 20, because this movie was so big, they believe all those other movies are going to be that much more desirable and excited. And then got Guardians of the Galaxy, a bunch of new characters to mix in. And they think by the time they get to Avengers 2, people are going to be losing their mind in anticipation.
And then I think, they'll make another Batman film, throw Batman into the mix.
Different studio, different studio.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. I get confused by all these superheroes.
Batman and Superman are DC.
Surely I know that. I'm kidding. I'll say this much. One title I know will have a sequel, it might take about 4 years to make it, will be the Olympics. Or, since we have not...
Two years.
Well, that's true. The Summer Olympics. Or, as I saw SiriusXM, they sent me an email telling me all of their programming surrounding, quote-unquote, the Summer Games. Obviously, they did not want to get dinged by the Olympic Committee for using the word Olympics improperly or without some kind of license, so they called it the Summer Games.
Does that not follow? I think that follows under their license, though.
Well, it does.
Because I remember there were shops in London that they were going around saying, take down that notice saying, hey, let's go games, like free Olympic haircut. I'm like, take that down. They were very draconian and not very sensible about it, If a little hairdressing store has a little sign in the window saying "Go Tom Daly" and they have a little haircut special, you shouldn't drop the hammer on them. If it's a store with an ad in a paper promoting an Olympic game lunch special, then you go crazy.
Right,
but
in this
something
case,
local, small, unrecognized by anybody, you let it. You got to protect your copyright, but I don't think that's going to really endanger it. A little hand drawn sign in a window.
Well, in the case of SiriusXM, it's all radio. So it's a commercial endeavor. So they're not going to say the Olympics when they haven't licensed it.
Right, but aren't they involved with them?
No, not at all. There's just like people on sports channels talking about the Olympics.
Oh, nonstop, of course. Well, I'm sure that they, then the Summer Games must be okay. But the Summer Games are doing great, of course. They're a massive hit on television. People complaining about NBC's tape delay, which I think is silly, because if you're a subscriber, you can go online and watch the games. You can watch live streaming for most of the big events here in North America on NBC.com. But people are also flocking to the television. And it's up like some nights 30, 40% over Beijing, you know, some really big nights. I think even on slow nights, it's still up like 14%. So the ratings have been very, very strong. Every night has been bigger than the same night 4 years earlier at Beijing. So a nice, solid TV success for NBC.
And that's just here. I was going to say that's just here in the United States. I mean, you had for Gabby, as she's known, her gymnastics all around win 35.
The flying squirrel,
35.7.
Horrible name.
I didn't make it up. Nearly 36 million people watched it last Thursday in the U.S. alone. And, you know, of course, it's tape delayed. And the criticisms, first off, I guess two things. One, when you say you have to subscribe to watch it online, you have to be a subscriber to a cable or satellite.
A pay television service.
Right. So that's, you're not subscribing to the Olympics or NBC Online. It's, you have to have pay
I can
TV.
Just go onto my lap, my iPad, and I can watch the game streaming.
Right.
Even if I'm away from my home, even if I'm in another state.
That's correct.
All you got to do is type in a thing. So that's a huge innovation. So they're saying, hey, you want to do it? Log onto your computer, go onto your iPad. You can watch the games. Go right ahead. Knock yourself out. And in fact, the women's gymnastics final was streamed by live people, 1.4 million live streams, which is the most ever. And that obviously will just keep increasing as the world of iPads continues and people realize what's available. NBC's been a little cagey about what's been going online on the web, but they've said they've had like 100 million page views on that day of the women's gymnastics, 105 million minutes of video, 78 million of it live. I mean, so people are watching clips. I watched the clips of the men's 4x100 individual medley because my DVR hates me and it didn't tape it properly. So I was able to go online and watch that whole race. It was, you know, great.
Well, you know, I think a lot of the criticisms have gone on to not necessarily be about the tape delay, because there's really not much you can do about that, but the way
you can show it live in the afternoon.
Well, I think it's the way the programming is cut up and presented in prime time from 8 to midnight, and the way, for instance, there was a lot of criticism about the way the women's gymnastics team event was portrayed. I guess there was a battle between Russia and I'm going to mess this up, but I want to say Romania for the bronze medal. And I could be, you know, who was going to come in third place or second place. I'm getting that wrong. But there was more of a battle, whereas NBC only showed the Americans and then they showed the Russians crying. But the reality was, if you watched it live, that there was no way the Russians were going to win because of a floor routine that had been messed up. And so it was far less suspenseful in reality than what they showed on television.
Well, you're saying two things. You're saying that they focus on the Americans, but they also distorted another story. If they didn't even focus on it, how can they have distorted it? I think in general, they didn't show every event, you know, they didn't show every apparatus. I always prefer to see it live, of course. That's why you go online. Then you don't have to complain. You can watch everything the way you want. When you watch in prime time, you're going to get it with a little feature presentation about one of the big athletes in the big event. You're going to get a little soft human focus thing, and then you're going to get the event. The women's gymnastics, if they showed it live and showed it full, I mean, I watch, you know, Big Ten championships and Big Ten competitions all the time. It takes a couple hours.
Yes, it's, you know, like 4 or 5 hours.
Well, it's not 4 or 5 hours, but it's a solid 2 hours. You know, you go to the gym, you're there for a good 2 hours while they all do their rotations. And they all take place at the same time. You know, you have people on 6 different apparatus all at the same time. Like maybe the one college is doing this and the other guy's doing that. So if you've got a Big Ten competition or something like this, there's a country on every single apparatus. And you got, you know, dozens of countries competing. Well, you could fill up 2 weeks with just gymnastics of nothing but that one event, women's gymnastics, for, you know, 24 hours a day. If you just showed it, you know, you'd fill it up for days and days on end. It's just not feasible. You have to choose. If they didn't do a great job, I don't know. I fast forward through most of the human interest and just get to the big event itself. You know, I just watch the actual competition. I don't watch anything live. I don't want to watch stuff live. I want to tape it and be able to fast forward through all the stuff and get to the good moments.
And do you know who's won beforehand? Have you looked it up?
No.
Oh, okay.
Because that's no fun.
Okay.
No. I don't go on news websites all day long.
Ah, okay.
Until I finish watching the prime time, I can't go to the New York Times or somewhere else. And, you know, I can't even go, you know, to, if I could choose, if I did want to watch it live, I might not even go to NBC.com. I might go to the BBC.
That's right. I think that actually what the BBC is doing here is absolutely phenomenal. They are kind of doing this narrow casting where you can program your own channel. They have 24 new channels that go directly to living rooms, and you, as a viewer, can pick what events, what sports get sent to a specific channel, and you can literally be your own NBC programming director, or in this case, BBC. You know, BBC 1, 2, and 3, those are the three channels that BBC has in the United Kingdom or Britain.
And they're showing nothing but nonstop Olympics.
I mean, they basically, they're like the Olympics channel.
All right, because it's in their home country. And, you know, but that's just literally, they're just devoted to it. They don't have any other day programming. It's Olympic, Olympic, Olympic.
Yeah, you'd think that because of that, that there would be no real need for what they're calling a red button program. But 17 million people have actually used the BBC red button to watch some form of the streaming events for at least 15 minutes over the
past
week.
Right, so this means people don't have to go to their iPad or their laptop. They can use that gigantic high-def TV they paid good money for and watch those events right on their TV rather than having to get it on their iPad and stream it to their TV and set up some connection. It's being done for them.
I think this is so brilliant. I think this is exactly the way that this type of sporting event, if not other sporting events, should be done. Get an extra channel, put some, and in this case, 24 extra channels.
Yeah.
But, you know, not every event is the Olympics. So,
well, look at boxing on Bravo in America for 5 days, 6 days, 7 days. It was boxing on Bravo all day long, every day.
That
was it. The only sport they showed. That's what, you know, you're talking dozens of sports, of course, at the Olympics. But for the big marquee events, you would have, you could just say, oh, I want BBC 17, that stream, which is all gymnastics, or all swimming, or all diving, or all wrestling, or all track and field, whatever it might be, polo, volleyball, you know, that's, you know, they just need the capacity. They need the bandwidth. They need to have the cable providers cooperate. And they're getting there. You can do it online in a lot of ways, and they're going to get it to your television pretty soon.
Yeah, I mean, BBC is really kind of blurring the lines with each platform, the online versus the television in the living room. I think they're doing a good job of that, and they're succeeding.
Right, you shouldn't have to go to your iPad. If you want to watch on that big TV, why not? That's why people are using, you know, doing workarounds so they can access the BBC website.
Yeah, well, how would you do that? Of course,
well, there
I know.
Are companies, you know, there are people who love BBC programming or British programming, and if you're overseas, you can't access it. You can perhaps sometimes sign up for a buy, you know, they pay their annual fee for their television. You could technically buy that, but you're not really supposed to access it overseas. So that's illegal anyway. So you can't legally be overseas and pay to access the BBC television stuff that you can get if you are in the UK. However, there are proxy servers, little companies, that will let you change your IP address so it looks like you're in the UK. So therefore, when you try to log onto the BBC website, they see my computer laptop here in Long Island City, New York, it looks like I'm in Leeds, London, or Leeds, England, I should say. And they say, all right, fine, you can access it. And so you pay these companies a flat rate a month or a year, and you can pretend to be based in the UK and therefore get access to stuff that is restricted to that country.
Not that you would ever do such a thing.
Well, I couldn't be bothered. Honestly, I couldn't be. But I did want my sister to set up Slingshot, which Slingbox, which is the same idea in a way. It lets you access someone else's TV. I did try to set up a Slingbox on her UK TV so I could watch British television back here in America just for work purposes. I wanted to see the shows first and be able to cover them and promote them and talk about them. You know, that's my excuse. But it'd be great to see Wimbledon, the BBC coverage of Wimbledon and all that stuff. But it was too complicated. Slingbox did not work well. Her home and her internet and her TV were all incompatible with each other, and her phone, all of it was sort of incompatible. And then to put the Slingbox in there and try to get it to me, it just didn't work out. It would have been great, and I'm sure we'll see it someday soon. But we are seeing a lot of people, we have seen a big surge in people signing up to these proxy servers here in America so that they can do this. They sign up for a month and then they drop it and they enjoy the Olympics.
Well, you know, something that I was anticipating for quite a while was Amazon bringing their instant video. You know, I'm an Amazon Prime subscriber, so I wanted to be able to watch those movies, those Amazon Prime movies, on my iPad. It's, you know,
Can't you?
No, not until last
week.
It's
only on the Kindle that you can do the Kindle Fire?
That's right. And now, finally, they've released kind of an app for the iPad, And it's free software. You know, you can download it, and it's in the iTunes App Store. And now I can watch, you know, all 120,000 titles in their video library there. And, you know, they have television shows, and the movies are older for the most part, and or you can rent or purchase movies to watch. I'm a Prime subscriber, so a lot of the Prime videos I can now watch that way. What's surprising to me about this is that, first off, Amazon usually reserved this for, as you say, the Kindle Fire, their own hardware. And now they're finally kind of saying, okay, we're going to do the same thing.
60 million, 80 million iPads out there. I guess we better be nice to them.
Right. We want people buying from us. We want people paying for that Prime subscription. It doesn't matter whether they have an iPad or a Kindle. We'll place the Kindle software on the iPad. They've already done that back in June. Amazon released an iOS version of their Amazon Cloud Player, which now allows people to stream music from their Amazon libraries. So they're kind of spreading out their platform. What's shocking to me is that Apple's allowing it.
Well, it just helps Apple tablet.
Doesn't help their iTunes.
Well, but, you know, that's okay. They're all about the hardware.
That's true and not true. I mean, they sold 1.3 million Apple TVs in the last quarter, but that amount
Apple TVs. Why are people buying Apple TVs?
Well, that's a real good question. They've sold 4 million Apple TVs to date in 2012, and now you can watch Hulu Plus on it. Last week,
All right. So we're talking about different ways you can access content.
That's right.
You can watch it on your big screen TV. Sometimes you can stream it to your TV or your tablet or your laptop. You can access some of your music library, some of the library of Netflix, some of the programming offered by a major network or the BBC. There are all these different ways of accessing content. And it's all coming together so that 10 years from now, obviously by then, your music, you'll be able to get anywhere, anytime in the world. Any channels that you subscribe to, you'll be able to access on your phone, your tablet, your television. You won't even think about it. It'll just be automatic. Whereas today, you got to jump through a bunch of hoops. In the future, whatever you access, you're going to be able to access anywhere, anytime, anyway. Doesn't that seem safe to say?
That's very safe to say. You know, what's remarkable is that, you know, you asked who's buying Apple TV. Well, that's a good question. I mean, last year they sold, 2 million Apple TVs. This year they've already sold 4 million.
So Apple TV is just a little box that lets you stream video and audio from your laptop, from wherever you store your media, to your television.
That's just right.
A way of getting that info from your laptop to your TV, because why watch stuff on your little, you know, laptop screen when you've got this 46, 65 inch TV sitting there?
That's right. Now, Apple makes far more money and far more revenue from the iTunes store, so selling all the songs and the videos and the apps, than they do in selling this hardware. So I was a little surprised that they let Hulu Plus, which is bringing content to the Apple TV, they allowed it on. They must have a bigger play here. They must have a bigger play than just content and just hardware. There's got to be something going on here.
Politics?
No.
Content, hardware, there's not much left.
Well, there's got to be a bigger, more platform-driven play is what I'm saying.
Well, they're just making everything that they have more valuable. You know, the more content you make available on your thing, the better it is. It's nice to have a closed universe, but eventually, you know what? You're going to let – they have a Kindle app, right? You buy from Kindle, you can still read it on your iPad.
That's right.
It'd be stupid not to do it that way.
Right, because Amazon's all about selling the content.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you know, last week we talked about Netflix in Europe, in Western Europe specifically, and in the UK and Ireland.
This is another way to access a library. They provide you a library of movies and television shows and ways to – overseas, I think they're strictly a streaming service.
That's right.
Here in North America, they split it in two. You can still get physical DVDs sent to you, but the future for their business is streaming content to you, and they want to be able to do it in every possible way. So North America, they want to make these deals like with Amazon's coming to the iPad. Is Netflix available on the iPad? I assume, yeah. You just go to their website, and you can start streaming stuff on it and looking at it, right?
Yes, and you know, BSkyB has a movie channel now the streaming movie channel that was also added to Apple TV, so there's another way to watch movies, at least in the UK. Well, Love Film, which is similar to Netflix and is in the UK and other countries in Europe, the CEO, the former CEO, Adam Valkin, the founding CEO, I should say, he said that back in 2004, Netflix was on the verge of entering the UK and was like a day or two away from announcing before they decided to pull out at the very last second because it seemed like Amazon was going to launch a service.
They got scared. They blinked.
They got scared and they blinked. He says they decided the day before they launched to pull out because Amazon had announced they were going to launch in the UK. So Netflix said, well, if Amazon are going to launch in the UK, they're going to launch in the US, which means we've got to go back to the US and worry just about the US and let them have the UK.
So Amazon wasn't in the US yet, competing with video and streaming and all that stuff, obviously.
No, because it was 2004. Nobody had the bandwidth back then. I mean,
So they were going to potentially launch a DVD service?
Yes, it had to be, you know, rent by mail, which is what Love Film was originally.
And how would the CEO of Love Film know what Netflix and Amazon were doing? How would they know what Netflix's thinking was?
Well, because, you know, you're always, first of all, you're probably hiring people away. From, you know, if Netflix was going to launch and then they're not going to and they shutter that, well, now all of a sudden there's a bunch of employees available that you're probably hiring and they're telling you. You kind of always know what your competitors are doing to some degree. And 8 years later, it's very easy to see what's going on.
And why is this a big story? It's just a funny little anecdote.
It's just interesting. Yeah, I mean, we talked about it last week. And, you know, it's very easy in hindsight to say, well, 8 years ago when streaming was just, you know, a mere glimmer in people's eyes, you know, they could have launched and they could have had all of Europe by now. Well, you know, Love Film launched and he says we had to contend with Amazon, which was a tough company, but it was one of 1,000 things they were doing. So we competed with Amazon really well to the point when they actually sold us their competitor and they ultimately bought back the whole. So they bought Love Film is what the CEO, Adam Valkin, is saying.
So Amazon said instead of launching in the UK, they just bought this company once it made a success of itself.
Correct.
All right.
Yeah.
So is that a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I guess in hindsight, it's pretty much a big whoop if you were to ask me. Because, you know, hindsight is 20/20.
All right.
However, that does bring us to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story... The music festival Lollapalooza, brainchild of singer Perry Farrell, he's headed to Israel. Well, so is the festival, by the way. Once a massive success in the U.S., then left for dead, Lollapalooza has been reborn as a globe-trotting brand. In 2013, Lollapalooza will be held in, get this, Chicago, Chile, Brazil, and in Israel. Those shows, the ones in Israel, will take place Tuesday through Thursday so as not to offend religious prohibitions against the use of technology on the Jewish Sabbath, which runs from Friday night to sundown on Saturday, I guess it's sundown?
Yeah, Friday sundown to Saturday sundown.
Right. Perry Farrell told CNN, make no mistake, I want to have a beautiful portfolio of Lollapaloozas to give to my children, which I'm sure every child wants. That's what they always dream about, is having Lollapaloozas. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Big whoop, a music festival, add some dates.
All right.
Well, you know, it's nice though. I did think it was cool though. There was a story about, The Who adding a date. They are returning to Rhode Island like 30, 34 years, something like that. After a show was canceled, they were going to perform Quadrophenia. They were going to perform on the Quadrophenia tour in Rhode Island, but this was the date after the horrible tragedy in Cincinnati, and the mayor of Rhode Island of that province canceled the concert and said, no, it's too dangerous. We can't have it. And so fans 34 years ago obviously were frustrated. They missed out on seeing The Who in their peak. Well, now they're doing a tour where they're performing Quadrophenia live, and they're coming back and they're returning to that city for the first time in all those decades. And in a goofy sort of twist, they are honoring tickets purchased for that date. If you still held onto your ticket, you can turn it in and go see the show and not have to buy a new ticket, which I think is kind of cool.
Right, and that show was in 1979, and if you still have your ticket, if you've held on to that ticket, then there's a producer from Hoarders that would like to speak with you.
No, I have tickets going back, and those tickets, I think, were about $12.50. Those, were, I think, were good seats at the theater for that night. And but nowadays, of course, if you had to buy a new ticket, you could pay $600 and more, and that's just from the Ticketmaster. You know, if you actually have to go to a scalper, God help you.
Warner Brothers is so excited about Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby, which we've talked about here on the show, that they're going to make you wait another 7 months to see it. The potential awards contender starring Leonardo DiCaprio and based on the acclaimed novel by, you know, that guy who writes books, you know, like the Hemingway guy.
Oh, F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, that guy. Gatsby was a classic prestige picture set to debut wide on Christmas Day. Instead, Warner Brothers is pushing it back to July of 2013, where it will be competing with movies like The Lone Ranger, Despicable Me 2, and a 3D reissue of Will Smith's Independence Day, because everybody wants to see that.
Counter-programming.
That's right.
I guess the Gatsby.
They're moving the film from one prime slot to another, so this doesn't have the smell of desperation necessarily. Warner Brothers is loaded with Oscar contenders like The Hobbit, Cloud Atlas, and Ben Affleck's Argo, plus DiCaprio won't have to compete with himself since he's in the Quentin Tarantino extravaganza Django Unchained, and that's still, you know, set to come out on Christmas Day. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, once upon a time, it would have been a big deal. Anytime you moved a really big movie, they thought, oh, no, something's horrible, something's terrible, something's wrong. I just don't think it matters anymore. As long, you know, people know if it's a bomb and know if it's looking like just a turkey and they're moving it to hide it. And they just know. And it doesn't disguise the fact. They're just saying, all right, we think maybe if we move this to March, we'll do okay. It's a better idea than what we're doing. I think when a movie is good or they have confidence in it, switching it to another date doesn't really give it the aura of impending doom. However, The Gatsby is a terrible book to adapt into a movie. The other adaptations have been absolutely stillborn. I don't have a lot of hope for this just because of the nature of the book, but we'll see. But I don't think it looks like a bad thing. I think, of course, Gatsby should have stayed at Christmas and Django Unchained should have moved to July, because if there was ever a summer movie, surely that, you know, crazy over-the-top Tarantino is the thing that belongs in summer.
Well, I don't think Warner Brothers, you know, could ask Miramax to move, the Weinstein Company to move the film.
That's true. And of course, you know, this sort of, oh my God, people assume that Great Gatsby would be a contender for top Oscars. I didn't, because I think the books, again, don't make a really good source material to make a great movie. They could, you never know. But the last version was horrible with Robert Redford. But of course, the Hollywood Reporter, in talking about the movie, says, quote, many believe that Leonardo DiCaprio might finally win the Best Actor Oscar that has long eluded him for his portrayal of the film's title character, Jay Gatsby. To which I say, why? None of you have seen the film. You have no idea what it's like. Why would you assume not only he's going to get nominated, but he's going to win? I mean, if you're making a list of potential contenders, sure, of course. But he's going to win? Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, that I would agree with that. But what did you think of the rumor that Jimmy Fallon from NBC's Late Night, produced by, of course, now I probably, Lorne Michaels. I couldn't think of the name Lorne Michaels. So the Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, the host Jimmy Fallon, rumor is, he is negotiating to be the host of next year's Oscars.
Well, rumor was, because Lorne Michaels has been asked to be the executive producer. And now they say Jimmy Fallon, you know, the last guy to be working the Academy, was negotiating with both of them. They signed on Lorne Michaels, but he didn't finish the deal before he stepped down. Now we have a new Academy president. They're sort of starting from scratch. People say maybe Jimmy Fallon has fallen through the cracks. Other people say, oh my God, he can't host it because he's on a different network. That's ridiculous. I mean, Johnny Carson was on NBC, and he hosted the Academy Awards for ABC 5 times. So, you know, I don't think there's any problem about it being Jimmy Fallon. Jimmy Kimmel can't do all of them. Jimmy Kimmel's doing the Emmys, and frankly, even that's a stretch for him. Him at the Academy Awards would just be doofusy. So, you know,
He doesn't strike me as an Academy Awards kind of guy. Plus, he does that show right after the Academy Awards.
Well, that's why they think he makes sense, because, oh, he's already got that link to the Academy Awards. But he's a guy sitting there making fun of it. He's not a guy to do it.
That's right.
Jimmy Fallon, I'm not a big fan of as a talk show host, but he is the sort of right amiable, doofusy host. He could, you know, pull it off. Oh, my God, I'm so excited to be here. Oh, my God, there's so many stars. Oh, my God. You know, but I don't know. It's not a bad idea,
that's actually a very good
impression
of him.
Thank
you. You know, funny enough, you know, Jimmy Fallon, known for impressions, for doing, like, spot-on, dead-on impressions of different
celebrities. Neil Young,
he's like perfect. And Bruce Springsteen, he's not so bad at either.
Yeah.
Well, the parade of music superstars, two of whom I just mentioned, we have Bruce Springsteen and Neil Young, but those aren't the superstars I'm talking about. The parade of music superstars I'm talking about is appearing as judges on TV singing competition shows, and that list continues to get longer. New additions Britney Spears and Demi Lovato and Mariah Carey may be joined by, get this, Nick Jonas of the Jonas Brothers.
Wasn't somebody from One Direction available?
I don't think so. You know, Nick Jonas is called the president by his brothers, though the youngest, he's always been the leader. The 19-year-old tweeted to his fans that the rumors of him being considered by Idol were true, and that joining the show would be a dream come true.
Yeah, right.
Big deal.
Ever
or big
since
whoop.
I was 17, I've dreamed of joining Idol.
Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, I guess, in general, for people who care about reality television and this sort of thing. It's the second biggest show in the country, no longer number one. I think it'd be a great choice, assuming he's willing to be a good judge. I mean, all these people, we have no idea what they're going to be as a judge. Are they willing to be tough? You know, they can't imitate Simon Cowell, but they can be not just, oh, you know, they got to have personality. They got to have, you know, fun, and they've got to be able to critique and not pull punches, not by being mean, but by being pointed and accurate and sharp. And they don't help anybody or the show or the entertainment value by being wimpy. If Nick Jonas is willing to be a tough but fair-minded judge, I think he's a great addition. He's a very smart guy. He's a young guy. It would bring the show's age down for the judges, get a really relatable person up there. I think it'd be cool.
Yet another best-selling author has been caught plagiarizing. This time...
What? Did you? Well, I didn't do it. Oh, not me.
Yeah, no. Again, we're going with best-selling author.
Oh.
You walked right into that one. This time, however, at least he was caught plagiarizing himself, as well as making up quotes from Bob Dylan and who knows who else. The writer is Jonah Lehrer. Just over a month ago, he was taken to the woodshed by editor David Remnick over at The New Yorker. Savvy online critics pointed out that blog post Lehrer was writing for The New Yorker contained a lot of recycled blog posts he'd already used elsewhere. In June at The New Yorker, he recycled material from a blog post he'd done at The Wall Street Journal in October of the previous year. Turns out he'd been doing the same at Wired, The New York Times Magazine, and elsewhere. Instead of being fired for violating his contract and pawning off old material as new and original, Lehrer was, I'm almost tempted to say here, he was given a job at a Hollywood movie studio, but he was severely reprimanded by Remnick. Remnick surely regretted going soft when, just a few weeks later, it turns out that Lehrer's best-selling nonfiction book, Imagine, How Creativity Works, contained made-up quotes from Bob Dylan. Lehrer, of course, has resigned from The New Yorker, and the book is being pulped, and e-copies are not available anymore online, despite the fact that it sold more than 200,000 copies already, which is kind of saying something. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Copies are still available at the Museum of Natural History. I don't know why they have copies of the book, but my guests in town, Jesse and Adrian, they, father and son, went to the Museum of Natural History, and there in the bookstop was Imagine, and he took a photo of it and sent it to me because he thought it was funny. You know, I guess they didn't get the memo that the book has got some fake material in it. I think it's unbelievable. He's a savvy young blogger. You know, he was a blogger at Wired, lured away by The New Yorker. He's supposed to be smart and savvy, and he thinks he can use stuff from October and June and that the fans who followed him there to there are not going to notice. I can't believe he wasn't caught sooner, frankly. But it's just mind-boggling to me. I'm sure, you know, he's 31, and in the year he'll be back doing something else, and everybody's, everything's forgiven. That idea that he would do that in the first place is just astonishing. I mean, make up a quote from Bob Dylan about creativity. He's only given about 8 gazillion interviews in his entire life, and you have to make up a quote? You can't find one? Like, I mean, come on.
I was reading a story that basically made it sound like Bob Dylan was responding to this controversy, and it seemed like he was responding via email. And I read, like, the first paragraph, and I thought, oh, this is a little odd. It doesn't sound like something Bob Dylan would write. And by the second paragraph, I realized the whole thing was a hoax.
That's what happens when you get your news from The Onion.
Yeah, no, it wasn't The Onion. It was like Vice Magazine or something like that, or, you know, Vibe Mag. It was very funny, nonetheless. But
I think Bob Dylan expert, a Bob Dylanologist, who broke the story because he saw a quote from the author that he didn't recognize. I mean, and he knows every quote Bob Dylan's ever given. He's like, where'd you get this from? And Lehrer just started lying his ass off. He said, blah, blah. It's like, what? No, seriously, where'd you get this from? This doesn't make sense. It doesn't track. I haven't seen this anywhere. It's like, oh, well, I got it from interviews that were done for Martin Scorsese's documentary, No Direction Home. They were never released, but they let me see the outtakes. Like, I was like, really? Because this and that doesn't really track. And this, what about this story about Like a Rolling Stone, the creation of his classic song, his classic single? He's told these versions all throughout the years, and this doesn't matter. He's like, oh, well, he just kept, you know, spinning his wheels and lying to it, finally cracked and said, all right, I made it up.
Yeah, I think that this is kind of, a result of everybody, this race to become the next Malcolm Gladwell and, you know, be a big hit with best-selling novels about
He did it. You know, he created a blog. It was a big success on Wired. He got hired by The New Yorker. And instead of continuing to do this successful stuff, he was going on lecture circuits. He had this book. He was touring. And, you know, he just took on more work, I guess, than he could do. And he just got lazy and just started recycling old material. When, you know, you're not supposed to take an old article and republish it with a new date on it. They get a little annoyed at that. And then in the book, he was pulling quotes from a lot of sources. It wasn't like he was pretending that he'd interviewed most of these people. Most of them were quotes culled from other areas. So he just didn't bother to find the quote he wanted from Bob Dylan, assuming there was one that existed that would work with his theory of imagination and creativity and how it worked. He just got lazy and made one up. It's like, all right, you sold 200,000 copies. Way to go. Well, now you're a loser.
Well, we're not lazy here at Showbiz Sandbox. In fact, we follow up some of the stories we've talked about in the past. Here's a follow-up story. Yes. Remember when we talked about Raging Bull 2, and there was this lawsuit over Raging Bull? Well, MGM has dropped its lawsuit against the new movie about boxer Jake LaMotta. The film was called Raging Bull 2, but the producers of the film have now agreed to call the film The Bronx Bull, because I guess he's from the Bronx there, which, you know, actually, that name is a nickname for LaMotta during his career.
Yeah, he wasn't called Raging Bull.
Yeah.
He was called The Bronx Bull.
Right. Well, it was, you know, they have to make clear that this film has no connection to the Martin Scorsese classic, Raging Bull. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. The producer should have done it in the first place. Calling it Raging Bull 2 was ridiculous. You know, they didn't make Raging Bull. They had no rights to that film. They could have just named their film this thing in the first place and never would have had a lawsuit. I'm sorry they didn't have to pay some money, frankly, but, you know, come on. Can't call movie Star Wars 2. Sorry, even if you're somehow pulling on the same source material, be a little more original. I know you want to piggyback on the success of that film, but when you're not involved in it and you have no rights to it, you know, and it wasn't even his name, wasn't his nickname like the Bronx Bull, you might say the Babe. Hey, I can make a movie about Babe Ruth. I've got my own material on him. This is like an own original title. So they were pushing it to begin with, and they have a good cast. So who knows? It's unlikely that it'd be even remotely 100th as good as Raging Bull, but maybe they have a good film here, and now they don't look so cheesy like they did before by calling it Raging Bull 2. So frankly, it's to their benefit.
Online newspaper The Daily, really it's an iPad newspaper, well, they're gasping for breath. The would-be, I feel like I just announced the women's gymnastics, you know, every time there was a slip-up, ooh, that's a devastating blow, that's going to be a point off. The would-be trailblazer, The Daily, has just laid off a third of its staff, which the paper's editor lamely tried to spin as allowing it to be, quote-unquote, more nimble editorially. They've eliminated... yeah, I don't get that. They've eliminated sports...
We're very nimble here. We have no people getting in the way of the news.
That's right. They've gotten rid of sports and opinion as standalone sections. Though photo
sports.
Galleries...
No sports.
No
really.
Sports. Especially, okay. You should do this during one of the biggest sporting events the Olympics, come on. You know, photo galleries focusing on sports will continue to appear.
Thank God.
You know, are photo galleries eligible for Pulitzer Prizes, by the way, Michael? I don't think they are. This comes after a month of speculation about the site's fate, which editor Jesse Angelo countered by saying, staffers should, quote-unquote, ignore the haters, which apparently we've now become two of them. The New York Times reports that it is losing $30 million annually, or as News Corp, which owns The Daily, says is, last week's payroll. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, it's yet another media outlet that has failed. We want to see more media outlets flourish. We're losing a lot of local independent media. It's going to be devastating 10, 20, 30 years down the road. This was a national paper. It wasn't quite like what we're seeing being lost around the country. It's more like USA Today. But it was a bold attempt to try and do something new in the online environment. Say, hey, you start from scratch. You're just online. What would you do?
Well, if you're just on the iPad, because you could only get it on the iPad.
Well, that wasn't smart. Not that there weren't 60, 70 million people with the iPad, but, you know, why limit yourself? Why not be on, you know, other tablets? But it's a shame, you know, and I guess those people should ignore the haters when they're online at the unemployment office. You know, it's just a sad day.
Rapper Snoop Dogg, he made a pilgrimage earlier this year to Jamaica, where he says he had a religious experience, or at the very least a Rastafarian experience. Now he believes in the reincarnation of Bob Marley.
He believes he is the reincarnation.
Oh, he is? I had no idea. Wow, big shoes to fill. You know, he has recorded a reggae album because he's done everything he can do with rap. No word on whether Snoop will still be dragging gals around on leashes, however. He now asks everyone to call him, not Snoop Dogg, Snoop Lion. A film about his journey will screen at the Toronto Film Festival this fall. I believe they call it a dogumentary.
Oh, God.
See what I did there? See how I, Snoop Dogg?
Unfortunately, I do.
Okay. Well, is it a big deal or a big whoop? And I'm not talking about my joke. I'm talking about Snoop Dogg's becoming Snoop Lion.
Well, it sounds like a big joke. I mean, calling himself Snoop Lion, you know, he's obviously had some great early singles. Great early songs, great tracks with Dr. Dre. It's not really a solo artist that interests me very much. He's been pretty flat commercially for the last few years. His albums have done nothing. Who knows? Maybe those will be artistically reinvigorated. Stranger things have happened. Reggae is a great genre, but it just seems like a kind of a, I guess it's common in rap. People change their names all the time. They're personas. So I guess I shouldn't be that cynical, but it just sounds a little lame.
No, and David Bowie became Ziggy Stardust. And, what's his name? Garth Brooks.
He didn't actually ask people to call him Ziggy Stardust. He performed the character Ziggy Stardust on stage. It was a David Bowie album playing the character in the album and on stage. But he didn't say, please start calling me Ziggy. You know, he said, I'm David Bowie. He got off stage. He said, hello, I'm still David Bowie. Hello, it's nice to see you. I'm David Bowie. You know, he didn't say, call me Ziggy.
Right.
And he didn't say, call me Aladdin Sane or call me, you know, the Elephant Man. He said, I'm the Elephant Man on stage. And then I come off and I'm David Bowie.
And actually, my real name is David Jones, but there's a little guy from the Monkees who stole that name.
You were in the Monkees?
No. That's why he actually goes by the name David Bowie, because David Jones from the Monkees.
Oh, that's right. He does. Yes, exactly.
Yes. Well, now, you know, I love this article from Fast Company, which says, Snoop Dogg's pivot. They tried to liken this to the way companies and startups pivot from one goal to another when they realize that, you know, one of their products isn't working right. They change their business strategy. And I thought, Snoop Dogg's pivot, like his business strategy isn't working, so he's going to do a reggae album. But according to Fast Company, it's the same as working for a startup.
All right.
Sight and Sound just announced the results of the most prestigious poll of film critics and directors in the world. The poll, taken once every 10 years, has crowned Citizen Kane as the greatest movie of all time for decades. But in 2012, the new winner is... Wow, you read my mind. Vertigo. Kane is number two, with the usual suspects in the top 10, including Renoir's Rules of the Game, and the most recent film in the top 10, Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. The director's poll had five different movies in its top 10, including The Godfather, Taxi Driver, and its most recent film in the top 10, Apocalypse Now. The most recent film in the critics' top 50? Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love.
Yay!
Big deal or big whoop, Mike?
Well, it's a big deal. I love the list. It's the most prestigious film poll of its kind. They were the first ones to do it. A lot of controversy this time around. First of all, they expanded the number of people they reached out to hugely, like by 10 times as many people. From like 60 or 80 people, they're now canvassing like 1,000 people. The annoying thing is that they said, hey, we want to expand the people we reach out to, make it fresher, make it newer, make this more substantive and, make it as telling as possible the film community out there in the world. So what did they do? They didn't just expand the people that they reached out to. They dumped all the people they'd used before. So if you'd done a previous Sight and Sound poll, they're like, never mind. We don't care what you think anymore. Andrew Saris, get lost. This person, get lost. That person, get lost.
Mr. Ebert, out of the way.
Yeah, even people who had helped found the Sight and Sound poll, the ones who created it, the editors of the magazine at that time, even they were dumped. So that was kind of obnoxious. And you look at some of the films that are not on the list, and you can see the power of DVD. Max Ophuls is one of the great directors of all time. In previous years, he's had one or two of his movies on this list, like The Earrings of Madame Du, or Letter from an Unknown Woman, or some others. But he sort of disappeared from view because Max Ophuls' son, what's his name?
Of course, what's his name? You know what? I'm just glad Max named him.
Marcel Ophuls, the great documentary filmmaker, Hotel Terminus, Sorrow and the Pity, a great filmmaker in his own right. He has been keeping his father's films off DVD because he resents his father, hates his father, young lover, who appears in all his films, hates them so much he's wanted to destroy his father's reputation for years. So when Criterion would come to him and say, can we put his movies out on DVD? He'd say, no, nobody can see his movies. And so they've disappeared from view. And you weren't seeing Max Ophuls' films getting revived, getting shown in theaters. They weren't out on DVD. People don't see them, out of sight, out of mind. They sort of faded from memory a bit. So now, in the last few years, Marcel's gotten ill. His movies have started to come out on DVD. Max Ophuls' films, his classics, The Myrians of Madame Du, one of the great films of all time. So now, you're just starting to be able to see them on DVD again. I'll bet come 10 years from now, with these movies all firmly ensconced in the pantheon, you'll see that his fortunes will rise once again. If you're not on a DVD, film critics aren't seeing you, aren't being reminded of you, can't remember what a great filmmaker you are if they can't see your films.
Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, I kind of highlighted a bunch of stories here because the cable companies...
They're not making money off cable anymore.
Well, yeah, they all announced their earnings last week, and in announcing them, it became very clear that they're losing subscribers. Time Warner Cable lost 169,000 subscribers, and you know, which is not as bad. Well, actually, it's worse than the 130,000 they lost last year in the same quarter. And you also had Comcast losing. Well, I guess that was Comcast that lost that much, and Time Warner lost a bunch, and DirecTV lost some. But they're making more money, believe it or not, on high-speed internet.
So are people cutting the cord, or are they just saying, I'm in a recession, I still haven't gotten a job, I can't afford a $110 cable bill?
I think it's the latter. I think with the economy, you're going to see people start to tighten their belts a little bit. What are they tightening? They're tightening, you know, all of the excess stuff, all the things they don't really need, and cable is one of them.
All right, so everybody's seen losses. Time Warner did lose 169,000. Comcast lost 176,000 subscribers.
Okay, that's what it was.
DirecTV lost, how many did they lose? They lost like 10,000 or something in this last quarter. They lost 52,000 subscribers, but they're doing really well overseas. So they're in Latin America, and they're starting to draw a bigger and bigger audience. Just like Netflix and Amazon are expanding around the world, DirecTV is expanding into the Latin America market. And, you know, if they're all losing viewers, they got to make money somewhere. So they're saying, hey, buy high-speed internet, buy these bundled packages. They get a bigger bang for their buck than somebody doing just a really basic cable subscription. And they're getting maybe fewer subscribers, but a higher ticket on them.
That's right. Yeah. And let's face it, you know, as we were talking about BBC's Red Button and, you know, the B-Sky B having their own movie channel now, and, you know, 20% of all bandwidth during prime time is, you know, dedicated to Netflix, you know, more and more. The broadband connection, the high-speed internet, is worth more than the video. It's certainly a high-margin item because it doesn't cost as much to deliver that product as much
and as... And yet they want to throttle you down and keep that pipeline open and penalize you for getting a lot of content online. So they want you to stream a ton of stuff, but they also want you to slow down or pay through the nose for it.
That's right. They want you to pay for higher tiers. You know, on the other hand, video subscribers, that costs them money. They have to pay for all that programming. Now, if you're Comcast or Time Warner, maybe you own a few cable channels and it doesn't cost you as much. But for the most part, you want to offer 500 channels? Well, you're going to have to pay for those 500 channels, and that's why we're paying $130 for cable every month.
But they still have to pay for those channels because they're not going to abandon their cable business. So they have to do both.
Right, but what I'm saying is that the margin is a lot higher on broadband than it is on offering video subscriptions. You know, I also think that if you look at foreclosures, when people lose their houses, you know what they don't need? They don't need cable because they don't have any place to watch it. So, you know, foreclosures are still...
When you moved into your parents' basement, they've already got cable.
Precisely. So when you have that kind of thing going on, of course, cable subscriptions and satellite subscriptions are going to go down. But more and more, you start hearing all of these earnings calls talking less about video subscriptions and cable subscriptions, and more about all of the other offerings, the internet offerings that are being sold by these companies.
Do any of them just, are people buying internet and not the cable?
Yes, and that's what Comcast kind of highlighted in their earnings call, is that they've kind of separated. You know, they used to sell it in a bundle, that you used to have to buy phone and internet.
Sure.
And now they've kind of unbundled it, and they're finding that their sales of internet alone without television is actually outpacing video, obviously, because, you know, video is going down.
Outpacing? You mean they don't have more people buying internet only than are paying for cable subscription?
No. But the sign up, the churn, you know.
Well, sure. Yeah. Because it's a new service. They haven't offered it before. Cable is a very mature business.
Yes.
Unless you move or you're a new young person graduating from college, you get your home for the first time, or you rent a place or whatever, you know, it's a pretty predictable, slow, very mature business. They're pretty much everywhere. Anybody who wants cable has it. There's no new worlds to conquer. they can keep adding new stuff to keep you excited, like DVRs and this and that.
And the 24 channels that the BBC has so that we can program our own Olympics.
But they're basically, it's a mature business. Though I would think high-speed internet would also be pretty mature. I guess it's not. America lags behind Europe so much.
That's true.
So what does this mean? This means, for viewers, it means, hey, 400,000 people have cut the cord for one reason or another. That has to impact the companies and help them say, hey, maybe we shouldn't keep increasing costs and what we charge our customers. Number two, I think it means that that pressure to create bigger pipelines and bigger networks that can handle a lot more high-speed internet and not charge to the nose for it is going to increase because they need to compete for customers. And how are they going to compete? By saying, hey, we've got higher speeds, we've got more pipeline, we won't throttle you down. Look at Google with their one gazillion byte, you know, bits of information a second coming to your home. You know, this is going to revolutionize it.
Wait, was that a gazillion byte? I'm going
to
write
that. A gazillion byte. It's a new technical term.
Just checking.
It has to do with the Higgs boson. I'll explain it later. But so with all that changes, I think you're going to see that high-speed internet is going to become an area where they need to compete and they need to provide better and more service.
You know, ultimately, when you, I liken it to what happened in the mobile phone space or the cellular space. Initially, you had all of these mobile phone operators and wireless carriers saying, oh, SMS messages cost, you know, $150 per megabyte. And I think it was like $1,500 a megabyte. And they would charge you for all these text messages. Then people found ways to get by them, either through Skype or through Mac messages or all of these, you know, Facebook messaging. And they said, okay, well, we won't charge you for SMS messages, but we'll charge you for data because that's how you're sending these messages. And so they started putting caps on the data usage, saying, well, our networks are being taxed. The same thing is going to happen here. They're going to say, well, okay, we won't charge you for television, but we're going to have to charge you for data because you're using too much data now.
But that's exactly, we have to have net neutrality. We have to have no data restrictions. We have to, you know, people have to fight tooth and claw for that.
Yeah. Now, speaking about fighting, last week you and I had a bit of a friendly debate, let's say, about the country and the island of Ireland. And someone wrote to us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
Who actually knows what they're talking about?
Yes, they actually know what they're talking about. In fact, I think you'll see they're actually from Ireland. The email address they sent that missive off to was dirt@showbizsandbox.com. It's Patrick from, Patrick from Dublin. Do you want to read it? Do you want me to read it?
I think you should read it since I'm the one in the wrong.
Okay. Well, I don't know if you are. Let's see. Michael and Sperling, it starts out. I was surprised that on episode 156, you got into an argument about whether Ireland was part of Great Britain or the United Kingdom. I'm ashamed of both of you. Sperling, you've actually been to Ireland and should have defended your position on the issue. Michael, how can you call yourself an Anglophile and not know that Ireland is not part of the United Kingdom? For the record, Ireland is an island. Which I when I read that sentence, I thought, well, yeah, okay, that's true. There are two separate countries on the island of Ireland. The larger is the Republic of Ireland, a sovereign state since 1955, and in no way connected to the government of the UK.
No, it's been a sovereign state longer than that, like 1922. And since 1955, they've had no connection to the government of the UK.
Ah, okay. Okay, so I guess I should read actually what Patrick wrote here. Yes, and since 1955, in no way is connected to the government of the UK. The second is Northern Ireland, which, like Scotland, Wales, and England, are part of the UK. Britain is also an island, which consists of England, Scotland, and Wales. When we refer to Great Britain, we are including all the islands that surround the island of Britain, such as the Scottish Isles and the Isle of Wight. This is the United Kingdom. The correct way to include Northern Ireland in the grouping is to say the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. When anyone refers to Ireland, they are or should be referring to the Republic of Ireland. Does that clear up the issue? Class dismissed. A loyal Dublin listener, Patrick.
Well, thank you very much for listening and filling us in on the nuances of that from the perspective of people who live on the island of Ireland. People still say Ireland, even though the island includes Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. What you call the Republic of Ireland is incredibly contentious. I looked this up when I knew this email was coming, and I looked it up last week after we talked because I knew I didn't know what I was talking about. So I looked it up, and it turns out Ireland refused to recognize extradition treaties and extradition warrants unless England, the UK, Great Britain, whatever you want to call them, would refer to them as Ireland. If they didn't call them by their proper name, they said, well, we're not going to acknowledge this warrant. you know, England would refer to them one way, they would refer to themselves as another, and they'd say, hey, this is the way we refer to ourselves, this is the way we're recognized internationally. If you can't bother to correct your warrant and refer to us the way we ask, we're going to ignore it. So it's a very contentious issue. Obviously, the Troubles have riven this nation, you know, this land for so long. Frankly, I think it's like East Germany and West Germany. I think in 100 years, they're going to be one country again. And I don't think you're going to talk about the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. It will just be Ireland again. And I think it'll be better for that the way it was through most of history, whether they were affiliated or not with the United Kingdom. So, and frankly, I'm not an Anglophile. I'm just a stupid Brit. I'm not an Anglophile. I'm an Anglo. I was born in Bermuda, so I'm a British subject, colonial born, but I never felt the bitterness about it that people in the Republic of Ireland felt. So I'm a little insensitive to those travails.
Yeah, there was also somebody who you know, we got a couple of emails on this issue, and somebody...
I hope you got no packages.
No, you mean ones that tick?
Yes.
Yeah, no. Well, that's because, you know, we don't give out our physical address here, although yeah. Michael's, yours is...
Never mind.
Okay. But, you know, we do have an email address. And again, it is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You know, you can call and leave us a voicemail as well. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher, maybe even on your Apple TV. Certainly, we can send you an email each time we post a new episode if you subscribe to our email list, or you can subscribe in an RSS reader. There are just so many ways to subscribe. And in fact, on some of those podcast aggregators like iTunes, you can rate and review our show, and we encourage you to do so, especially if you're going to give us a 5-star review. If you're going to give us a 1-star review, we do not encourage it at all.
We got a 1-star on geography. Obviously, that's apparently true, Patrick. You're absolutely right. But hopefully we get a 5-star in other areas.
That's true. I mean, we hope you've learned a little something on this show.
Well, Patrick taught us something.
That's true. Patrick is actually maybe the only person that...
who knows what he's talking about.
Exactly. You know, if you're looking for ways to subscribe to us or ways to contact us, all of that can be found on our website, which is showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode. Again, that website address is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Just yesterday, on Sunday, August 5th, they were, Michael, in Lehigh, Pennsylvania.
Oh, Lehigh Valley, where my brother lives.
That's right, playing a festival there. They're doing one or two festival dates, I think one in Lehigh Valley and one in Montreal. Michael, you have a website. It is?
It's MichaelISuckAtGeographyGiltz.com.
If I were you... if you're going to go visit Michael Giltz's website and read some of his writing, I would definitely take out that middle part, because I don't think you'll actually. In any case, some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.